Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I really count it as a special, exceptional privilege to be speaking today on The Morning Show with author Michael Shulman. He is a contributor and arts editor at New Yorker magazine. His work has appeared all over the place, and he has written an absolutely superb book about one of the world's greatest actresses, namely Meryl Streep. In a recent issue of Vanity Fair magazine, I read an excerpt from this book called Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. And I was absolutely enthralled, and I couldn't wait to lay my hands on the book. And happily, the book arrived before I could even go searching for it. And it was sent to me by an agent who hoped that I would be willing to interview the author. And more than willing, I'm thrilled, because it's just an exceptionally interesting book about a woman that so many of us admire, and yet, in some respects, don't know all that much about. For as public a figure as Meryl Streep is, she is, at least in some respects, a private person, not in the sense of certainly being reclusive, but the story of Meryl Streep has never been about what happens off the screen or off the stage. We admire her and know her for her extraordinary career and the superlative work that she has done for all these decades, and done with such grace and gratitude. But it is so exciting to be able to, in a sense, step behind what we know from the public face and public work of Meryl Streep to understand something about where she comes from and the early years of her life and early years of her career that helped shape her into the irreplaceable artist that she is. Michael Shulman has done exactly that with his book published by HarperCollins, again called Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. Michael Shulman, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh my gosh, thank you for that amazing introduction.
Well, I meant every word. I have to confess, although I know a lot about Meryl Streep, I did not immediately understand the title of the book. I actually had to wait until I'd read into the introduction a bit. I suspect some of our listeners will immediately know what phrase, in a sense, is being coined or quoted there. But for the sake of those who don't, explain the title and why you chose it.
Well, so the title comes from, it's something she said when she won the Academy Award in 2012 for The Iron Lady. She got up and she said, "Oh, when they called my name, it was like I could hear half of America going, oh, come on, why? Her. Again. But whatever." And I love that speech. I love all her acceptance speeches. I think she's managed to create this, I guess I would call it a persona at this point in her career, where she can sort of undercut her own hype as the greatest living actress, as she's often called. And I chose that because the premise of my book is that I wanted to look into her early life, specifically her 20s, what her life was like in the 1970s as an up-and-coming actress, and how she became this iconic figure, this, you know, the greatest actress of her generation. What were the forces that shaped her? So I chose the title because I thought it was really funny. I thought it sort of reflected her own sort of irreverence toward herself, but also because I wanted the book to be a portrait of her again, meaning a second look at someone in a way that we don't quite know her, which is as a young, untested person.
You know, I almost feel funny asking this question, because as I got done reading your book, I thought someone should have written this book a long, long time ago. I mean, this is just the greatest idea for a book ever. And yet, I'm really curious to know how the idea occurred to you. To not write, for instance, a sprawling biography of Meryl Streep that would have covered everything she's ever done, or mm-hmm. or in some other way, something that would have really sort of taken us through the length and breadth of her long career. Did anything in particular inspire you to focus, in a sense, so narrowly? Although I don't want to give the impression that this is a narrow, confined book. It's a terrific book. But how did the idea of focusing it in this way occur to you?
Well, actually, one thing that inspired me was Patti Smith's book, Just Kids, which is a wonderful portrait of her and Robert Mapplethorpe as young kind of vagabonds in 1970s New York City. And what I thought was so magical about that book is that it just focuses on who she and Robert Mapplethorpe were as young people and before their careers took off, and it ends. I mean, it really essentially ends, the story ends when they're on the cusp of fame. And she didn't need to say, you know, go on and say, oh, and then I became a famous punk rocker and he became a famous photographer, because in a way we know that story. You know, we know the story of their, you know, their great acclaim and their public careers. But I thought it just lent that book a certain kind of enchantment just to see who they were before that. And, you know, I think I really thought about my book as an origin story. You know, I really wanted to contrast the Meryl Streep who we know now, who gets up and says, oh, her again, and is this assured queen of Hollywood, this kind of diva, with someone who I thought would be completely different. You know, I wanted her to be unfamiliar in a sense by presenting her as a 20-something.
Hmm.
I mean, I was also inspired by, you know, stuff like, you know, Girls, even the TV show Girls. You know, I'm as a portrait of, you know, 20-something women in New York City trying to make it in the world, trying to figure out their place. So I love 1970s New York. I love stories about New York theater. So it all just kind of clicked for me.
By complete coincidence, as soon as I'm done speaking to you, I'm going to be speaking to another author about somebody else who's quite extraordinary. I won't even mention the title of the book. This is your interview, but that book is about Harper Lee, the reclusive author
of
To Kill a Mockingbird. And I'm just struck as I have these two books sitting right beside them, each other on my table here, that two books about two extraordinary women. And in the one case, needless to say, the author has written this book with absolutely no cooperation or help whatsoever from the very private and reclusive Harper Lee. I'm curious about your book, which I sense was written without Meryl Streep's direct cooperation, but I have no reason to think that she wouldn't welcome such a wonderfully written book. In fact, did you have any actual connection with Meryl Streep during the writing of this book?
Well, she did not. She did not give me an interview for the book. I had met her a couple years ago. I wrote a New Yorker piece in the Talk of the Town section where I interviewed her and some of her kids. Actually, that was when her kids were sort of just becoming actors and starting to get known. And that kind of fueled the fire of my interest. But I knew that, you know, starting on the book project, that, you know, knowing what I knew about her then, I just knew that this is sort of not her thing. You know, I think to her great credit, she has fashioned a life for herself that is very normal, that doesn't sort of, you know, she's not a Hollywood person. She lives in Connecticut. She's raised four kids. You know, I think she really goes out of her way to keep her own life normal and private. And I give her absolute credit for that. But, you know, I think if she had wanted to do a sort of authorized biography or a memoir or something, we probably would have seen it already. But I don't think we ever will. And so I wanted to write something that kind of respected that about her. And what I did was, as I was starting my research, I was reaching out to people who had gone to drama school with her. That was how I started. And I quickly thought, well, you know, I don't want her to hear about this secondhand from one of these people that I'm, you know, rooting around talking to people. So I wrote her a letter and tried to explain who I was and what I was interested in, what I was about. You know, I'm this sort of theater nerd who loves Christopher Durang and the public theater, and that was at the heart of kind of what I care about. not just a kind of random Mamma Mia fan who just loves Meryl Streep, although I love both of those things, Mamma Mia and Meryl Streep. But I tried to approach it from more of a scholarly place. And so I wrote her all that, and I tried to give her an idea of the framework of the book. And she wrote back a week later through her publicist, which surprised me.
Wow.
And I was completely delighted to hear from her because, you know, I was my very own note from Meryl Streep. And it was so interesting, this letter she sent me, because basically it was a lot of her anxiety. She sort of like told me what her anxieties were about someone writing a book about her, which is completely understandable. But the particular neurosis she had about it wasn't what I expected. Really, what her hesitation was is that she doesn't like being put on a pedestal, and she finds it really constricting to be praised so much and to be called greatest loving actress. She had one line that I really loved, which was something like, "Leave me to the thing I love. I love acting. But to be called the greatest living actress, a designation not even my own mother would sanction, is the opposite of good or valuable or useful. It is a curse for a working actor."
Wow.
And I found that so revealing into sort of how her mind works, because at the same time I had been deeply researching her early life, you know, and particularly her high school years, where she was she tried to be this popular girl, this kind of cheerleader, homecoming queen, and in the end found it very isolating and lonely. And a similar thing happened to her at Yale Drama School, where she became the star student and kind of the teacher's pet, and was put in every single production at the Yale Rep her final year, to the point where her peers and her classmates started resenting the fact that they couldn't get any roles. And I kind of realized that on some level, this is her MO, that she, whatever ecosystem she enters, she rises to the top because she's so talented, and then finds it a little bit isolating. And I thought that was so interesting, and that kind of became a motif in the book, where several points throughout her life, she was sort of, you know, on the homecoming float, or, you know, in this position where she was suddenly getting a lot of attention and didn't quite like it. So I found that really interesting. But in terms of my research, she sent me that letter, and after that, she kind of left me alone. You know, she didn't help me, and she didn't hurt me. I interviewed over 80 people, including friends, classmates, teachers, ex-boyfriends, and 95% of the people I approached gave me interviews. So I never got the sense that she was actively trying to stop me, which I actually thought was a very gracious way of doing it, just kind of letting me to my own devices.
We're speaking with Michael Shulman, and we're talking about his book just published called Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep. It focuses on the early life and the early professional career of Meryl Streep. The book culminates in the extraordinary film Kramer versus Kramer. One of my favorite moments from the first chapter, called Mary, and by the way, that's her name, isn't it? Mary Streep, I believe.
Yeah, Mary Louise, yeah.
Is you tell us a couple of examples that she recounts, I assume, in maybe past interviews or something, about some of the first examples of her experiencing the thrill of transformation. I especially love the story of something she did when she was 9 years old, and it, in effect, involved trying to transform herself into her grandmother. Do you remember this moment?
Yeah. I mean, this is an incredible way that she talks about her first really transformational acting experience when she was 9, and she, you know, she made herself up with wrinkles and tried to look like her grandmother, and she felt this wave of, I think, empathy, which is really at the heart of what she does, empathy, imagination, jumping into other people's skins, other people's lives. As, you know, she really felt this kinship with her grandmother by playing her. And then she says, you know, as a 60-something, she says, well, looking back, I look back at pictures of this, and I look like myself now and my grandmother then.
That's right. She says, I remember taking my mother's eyebrow pencil and carefully drawing lines all over my face, replicating the wrinkles that I had memorized on the face of my grandmother, whom I adored. I made my mother take my picture, and I look at it now, of course. I look like myself now and my grandmother then. But I do really remember in my bones how it was possible on that day to feel her age. I stooped, I felt weighted down, but cheerful, you know. I felt like her.
Yeah, and you think about roles like, you know, The Iron Lady, where she played an elderly Margaret Thatcher so convincingly. And I find it amazing that she had that experience. And also that makeup was part of it, because you think of all her roles through the years. She's a transformational actress, and I think that looking different really helps her inhabit someone.
Right. In addition to talking about some of these really early efforts of her to in a sense get a little taste of theater, even if it wasn't on the stage yet, you also spend quite a lot of time talking about her physical appearance. And the fact that Meryl Streep, at least in the most standard sense of the word, was not pretty. At one point you say Meryl Streep wasn't pretty, she was something else, something more interesting, or at least harder to categorize. And I think you talk about this as much as you do, not because it's necessarily a point of fascination with you, what Meryl Streep early on looked like, but the fact that it mattered to her.
Absolutely.
Help us understand, just because obviously she had a certain sort of allure, and yet again, as you just said, it was not what we would call sort of standard prettiness. What was it about her appearance that seemed to kind of make a difference, even if it wasn't in maybe the most conventional ways?
Right. Well, I mean, first I should say, any discussion of a female Hollywood actor has to involve some discussion of their looks, because looks are determinative when you're an actress. But in her case, I think it worked in a really interesting way, which was that she was completely insecure about her beauty when she was a teenager. And it's true that she's not a conventional beauty. She has these accentuated cheekbones and long sort of forked nose. You know, her features are not, you know, perfectly symmetrical. And she, as a teenager, she was, you know, looking at movie stars, who movie stars were, like Jane Fonda, Anne Margaret, Audrey Hepburn, Annette Funicello, and she saw people who were sort of these perfect, pretty women. And because of that, she really didn't feel like being a movie star was something that was open to her. And in the end, I think the kind of look she has was a complete asset. You know, I think of Bette Davis's eyes, those you know, famously accentuated eyes. I think with Meryl Streep, she has these features that really pop out on camera and make her irresistible to look at. In one of her, the cinematographer, Nestor Almendros, who shot Kramer vs. Kramer, actually said that shooting her was like shooting a Brancusi. You know, she has this statuesque, completely unique kind of beauty. And no, it's not a conventional sort of pretty, you know, perfect look, but it's, you know, she is completely, completely fascinating to watch. And also she has features that can sort of morph and, you know, she can look like different nationalities. She can look like an Eastern European person, like in Sophie's Choice. You know, she can kind of pull off a lot of different, kinds of people, and so that gave her a kind of door to quite a large range throughout her career. But I think that her insecurity about her looks was so interesting to track in her early years, from high school, when she was really, really had a narrow view of what women could look like and what movie stars could look like, through her breakout success in movies like Kramer vs. Kramer and Manhattan, when she was part of 1970s cinema, the New Hollywood, which was really starting to embrace people who had unique physicalities. You know, you think of the movie stars of that era, they're not perfect beauties. You know, the movie stars of the 70s were people like, you know, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro and Shelley Duvall, you know, people who looked interesting or ethnic or something. It was just a time that really embraced unconventional good looks.
My eyes lit up at one point in the first chapter, since I happen to be an opera fan, when I read that the first time, in your words, Meryl Streep felt the intoxication of applause was when she performed O Holy Night in French at the age of 12. And because she was kind of the neighborhood hellion in some respects, people were just sort of shocked and amazed and absolutely delighted by the performance that she gave. Just nobody had expected this. And so she eventually was enrolled in voice lessons with a highly esteemed voice teacher in New York City, Estelle Liebling, who's probably best known as having been the one and only voice teacher for all of her career of Beverly Sills. I didn't know any of this about Meryl Streep, and it's interesting to read about the aspirations that she had for a while, aspirations which eventually were dashed the first time she heard Beverly Sills actually perform.
Right, yeah. No, she was very interested in singing as a child and as a teenager. And, well, now she's singing in, Ricky and the Flash, so that's something.
Right. You spend some time talking about how during high school she seemed to find the need to take on a persona. She wanted to be a cheerleader. She wanted to be the homecoming queen. She wanted to have handsome, athletic boyfriends and so on. And as she looks back on that, and on some of the choices she made about how to, for instance, ingratiate herself with the boys she was interested in, she realizes now that she was engaged in some of the first protracted exercises in acting in her life.
Yeah, this was so fascinating, the way she talks about who she was trying to be in high school. It was this character that she fixated on. You know, she studied women in Cosmopolitan and 17 magazine, and she straightened her hair and dyed her hair blonde, and she joined the cheerleading squad. She made a conscious decision to try to be someone else, and part of that was appealing to the boys on the football team, and becoming the leads in all the high school musicals. And she says that this was the first character she played, and she studied it harder than any character she's ever played since. So it was that fierce determination and talent that she really had, talent for mimicry, for becoming someone else. But she just, her world was not big enough for her to actually sort of know how to use that talent. But nevertheless, she so successfully inhabited the character of this conformist, all-American, high school popular girl that she was elected homecoming queen her senior year, which is kind of like becoming best actress of her high school.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think it's so telling, the moment you say when she took, in a sense, her first plane ride and ended up flying over that little community of Bernardsville. You write, passing over Bernardsville, this is at the age of 18, she peered down and saw her whole life below, all the roads she knew, her school, her house, all of it fit in the space she could make with two fingers. She realized how small her world had been. Of course, her world gets much bigger when she heads off to Vassar, which at the time was an all women's school. And you write that this was, in many respects, a very liberating experience in which she began to formulate, in a sense, more of a genuine sense of identity, of who she really was and who she really wanted to be.
Yeah, going to Vassar completely changed her life and her sense of who she was. Part of it was that she was at an all-women's school, and she no longer had this constant pressure to impress the boys or to look perfect for boys. And she, part of the pleasure of researching this time in her life is that she was really a product of the second wave feminist movement. And I think she discovered feminism at Vassar. She discovered sisterhood, and she realized that life wasn't always about boys, and she could be her own person. She could feed her mind. You know, she read James Joyce, and she made her first genuine good friends, and developed a real kind of she completely changed. She left her hair unwashed for 3 weeks in a row one time, I think she says, and developed a kind of confidence in who she was. And at the same time, she discovered serious acting, which was also, of course, completely transformative. Her first role was as Miss Julie, the heroine of the Strindberg drama. And not only was this her first serious dramatic role, it was the first serious play she'd ever seen, and she was the star. So I think those two things go hand in hand. Her, Meryl Streep as a college student, sort of realizing that, you know, she could be her own woman, she could be her own person, and then also having this this sort of spiritual kinship with the Strindberg heroine, Miss Julie, and figuring out that acting really unleashed something in her.
Right. You also have as a recurrent theme in your book that of tenacity, and that there are various ways in which Meryl Streep both began her life with some sense of tenacity and then gradually gained more and more of it as she weathered various challenges. And one of them was when she made the decision to spend the fall semester of her senior year at an all-male school, Dartmouth, as part of some kind of an exchange program. And you write that it had not been easy to be in a place where women were so outnumbered by men, but those few months in Hanover had fortified her.
Yeah, this was so interesting. You know, she was at Vassar, which was all women, but they were just starting to admit men, so men were a complete minority. And then she goes for a semester to Dartmouth on an exchange where women were the minority. And the men, she says, were very hostile toward the few women who were enrolled there. You know, it was a really sort of fraternity-dominated atmosphere. She didn't feel comfortable there. There's this story about her and a girlfriend being in the library, and they had to go to the bathroom, and they held it, and finally started walking to the other end of the library, and the guys started like hissing at them and throwing paper or chuckling at them, like, you know, she says it was a completely hostile gesture, you know. And I think it really transformed her to be first in the the majority gender-wise, and then in the minority, and to see how it's kind of like both sides of the looking glass. And I think that helped her. I think it shaped her worldview about gender, to see it on both sides.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Michael Shulman about his wonderful book, Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep, in which he examines Meryl Streep's early life and her years of education and ultimately the earliest years of her professional career as she ultimately takes shape into being one of the finest actresses we have ever seen on the stage. We could probably spend an entire program just talking about what she experienced in graduate school at Yale, which somebody, Wendy Wasserstein, called the Yale School of Trauma, because it was an exciting experience, but with a real dark side. And it was painful for Meryl Streep on several different levels. I don't even know where to begin. And again, there's no way we can even touch on all the aspects of how important this experience was for her or how difficult it was. Maybe just pick a point and go.
Sure. Well, you know, I went to Yale as an undergraduate, and I did theater there, and I had always heard about this legendary time in the Yale School of Drama where Meryl Streep was there and Sigourney Weaver and the playwright Christopher Durang and Wendy Wasserstein, and they all did Aristophanes' The Frogs in the Yale Swimming Pool with music by Stephen Sondheim. It's their golden age. And when I started to look into it, which I'd always been curious about, I quickly realized that they were all completely miserable. You know, it was a complete pressure cooker. It was competitive. Everyone was sort of pitted against each other. Students would be put on probation if they, you know, if the faculty had some problem with them. And indeed, Merrill's first year, her acting teacher put her on probation because he said she wasn't trying hard enough, which completely shocked not only her but the rest of her classmates, because they already knew that she was the most talented person in the class. They were always there. They already started calling themselves the Meryl Streep class, and they had this slogan, "Streep it up," which they would tell each other. You know, if someone wasn't giving it their all on stage, they'd say, "Come on, streep it up." So for that person, their sort of class mascot, to be put on probation was completely shocking. And I think that was just a taste of how this environment was not very nurturing. It was really tough. And in the end, I think it probably did strengthen her and give her a sense of, you know, acting isn't just all play and in imagination, and you know, it has this real dark side, this real competition to it that can get very ugly.
Hmm. You say at one point, it's difficult being an outcast, but sometimes just as hard to be an asset. And the fact that Meryl Streep was so highly regarded by the director of this program and given one leading role after another, to the detriment of some other talented actresses in the group, I mean, that was its own source of pain for her. I mean, especially for someone as good-hearted as Meryl Streep.
Yeah. So her third year at school, her final year, she became a member of the Yale Repertory Company. And the dean of the school, Robert Brustein, put her in almost every single play that season in the lead role. And, you know, some of her female classmates were thinking, you know, I've been at this school for 3 years. Where's my leading role? And it became very tense between her and her classmates. I don't think they begrudged her talent, but they were also thinking, you know, I would like a chance. And she actually went to Dean Brustein and said, can I get out of one or two of these commitments? And he said no. She was so distraught about it. She got an ulcer. She went to a school psychiatrist who said, you know, give it a few months and then you'll be out of here and you won't have to worry about it anymore. But when she was there, she really felt the isolation and kind of the pain of being singled out and put on a pedestal. Mm. You know, it sounds like a little bit of a boo-hoo situation.
Yeah,
but
everybody should have such problems. But,
yeah, exactly.
But honestly, it was, I mean, the more we read, and I'm so glad you described this in such detail, because we really feel for her. We actually really feel for how difficult and painful that was for her. I actually love what the school psychiatrist told her when she kind of went for some counseling. You say that the psychiatrist told her this: you know what? You're going to graduate in 11 weeks, and you'll never be in competition with 5 women again. You'll be competing with 5,000 women, and it will be a relief. It will be better or worse, but it won't be this.
Yeah, well, now every time she's nominated for an Oscar, she's in competition with 5 women, so not exactly true.
Right. You write in the chapter called Isabella that the summer of 1975 was a brutal time to start an acting career. And I think you're referring to the fact that the country was going through a very difficult recession and all kinds of artistic opportunities were either being scaled back or drying up altogether. So this was a case where Meryl Streep's timing was not exactly impeccable. And yet, due to her blockbuster talent, she actually had a remarkably easy time of it. Not completely easy, but I mean, she was really able to score all kinds of important work, even at a time when the landscape was rather sparse. That probably says a lot about her natural ability at this point in time.
Yeah. You know, some people have asked me, who discovered Meryl Streep? And it's a hard question to answer because, you know, people, various directors, producers discovered her, but someone would have discovered her anyway. However, when she first came to New York City in 1975 out of drama school, she immediately fell in with Joseph Papp, who was an extremely important figure in her life, a mentor. He was the the founder of the Public Theater and the New York Shakespeare Festival, and he immediately put her on stage on Broadway at Lincoln Center, which he was controlling at the time, in Shakespeare in the Park, where he made her the leading lady just a year out of drama school, and really shaped how she, you know, he was, unlike some of her previous authority figures like Dean Brustein, I think he was much more of a kind of warm, fatherly, you know, paternal figure to her, and gave her a real theatrical home right out of the gate.
Hmm. One of my favorite moments in this chapter is when you describe a moment from opening night of Trelawney of the Wells, where she is performing on stage at the Vivian Beaumont. I mean, she is scared to death. I mean, so much hinges on this moment. And she's playing opposite an actor named Michael Tucker. And something happens, which in a sense sets her free from her anxiety, and the performance goes spectacularly well. This is a fascinating moment. Do you want to share it with our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Well, she was so nervous. She said her upper lip was wiggling, and she couldn't will it to stop. And then she went out. They started the scene, these two actors, her and Michael Tucker. And then a prop started falling off the table, and one of them went and caught it at the last minute. And that just broke the tension. And, you know, they set this prop upright. And from that moment, they just felt completely at home. And I think it's just one of those tension breakers.
Right.
Something real had to happen.
Right. And I find that fascinating, because I think we can imagine how, for somebody else, that might have not been that. That would have been this horrible distraction, and it would have all gone downhill from there. But for Meryl Streep, it's exactly what needed to happen. She wrote, and from that moment, everything was just fine, because something real had happened, and it pulled us right onto the table, into the world. And then all the work we had done in rehearsal and the life we had lived and who we were, we just located ourselves in the tactile world, and there we were. You write a few pages later that Meryl Streep came to New York with a primary goal, not to get typecast. And it seems that she was very successful in that regard. I mean, not just in these early years, but I mean, her whole career is a testament to that.
Absolutely. Well, from the beginning, she really had the sense that she did not want to be an ingenue. And she could have easily, at this point in her career, gone out to Hollywood, tried to be the latest blonde, starlet, beauty, sex object. But she was not interested in that at all. And I think that's a real testament to why she became successful in the way she did. You know, I sometimes think of her as a character actress stuck in a leading lady's body. You know, she has this incredible beauty that allows movie producers to make her the star of their films. And yet, that's not how she feels. She feels like, inside, someone who wants to be everyone. She wants to play old ladies and you know, weirdos and witches and fat people. And, you know, her breakout role in New York that year was in Tennessee Williams' play 27 Wagons Full of Cotton, where she played this kind of Anna Nicole Smith, like, busty Southern hussy character, and she wore prosthetic boobs, and, you know, this was what she wanted. And I think, you know, had she not wanted that, had she not felt like that was the kind of acting she wanted to do, you know, she might have had success as an ingenue, as the latest sort of pretty blonde to, you know, play Ophelia. But she says she didn't want to play Ophelia. She wanted to play Hamlet.
Absolutely. And John Lithgow, in talking about this performance you were just touching on in the play 27 Wagons Full of Cotton, said, "You could barely detect the moment when she slipped out of her own character and into the character of Baby Doll, but the transformation was complete and breathtaking. She was funny, sexy, teasing, brainless, vulnerable, and sad, and with all the colors shifting like mercury before our eyes." We need to jump ahead to the very, very important friendship, which becomes an important romance, with a fellow actor by the name of John Cazale. And this marks her deeply. And it's also the first time that she has in her life a boyfriend who becomes much more than a boyfriend to her, who wasn't, you know, a handsome, strapping athlete. John Cazale was a very different kind of man. What was it that drew her to him so powerfully?
Yeah, well, essentially it was what we call nowadays a showmance. They were cast in a play together. And in 1976, they starred in a Shakespeare in the Park production of Measure for Measure. And it's this weird sort of antagonistic but kind of kinky relationship between their two characters. And this spark just went off between them. I think it was really a romance between two actors who took their craft very seriously. You know, they bonded over acting, about their process and their the way that acting made them come alive. But they were a very strange couple. You know, they didn't. A lot of her previous boyfriends had been these kind of conventionally handsome football players or, you know, Broadway leading men. John Cazale was such an oddball. You know, he is best known as Fredo in the Godfather movies. And anyone who remembers him from those movies remembers him as this sort of crane-like, you know, balding, hulking, you know, strange kind of character actor. And he was an eccentric, too. You know, he was very slow and deliberate about things. You know, people told me these stories about how he would stay up all night futzing with his color TV to get the colors just right. You know, he was this very deliberate, very peculiar, almost childlike person. And they made such an unusual couple, and yet they were passionately, madly in love.
Hmm. And then, so tragically, John Cazale is diagnosed with what amounts to terminal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the decline of John Cazale is extraordinarily painful for Meryl Streep. And it is not long after that she finds herself cast in what is to be one of the most important moments of her or any actor's career, the film Kramer versus Kramer. I think it's so interesting how you help explore how this real-life tragedy had such a direct impact on the performance she gave in that film. Not only she herself, but also for the way in which that tragedy was used by her co-star, Dustin Hoffman. Tell our listeners about that.
Right. So John Cazale died in 1978 in March, and Meryl was really at his bedside. She threw everything aside to care for him in his final months. And obviously she was devastated. You know, this is her first great love died, you know, within 2 years of knowing him. And months later, only months later, she was cast in Kramer versus Kramer. And one story I tell is about her audition for that movie, which was so interesting to me because there's two completely different versions of the story. The way Meryl tells it, she walked in and she thought that they had her character all wrong. They thought that Joanna Kramer had been demonized and she wanted them to work, you know, rework the script and give her a sense of dignity and, you know, a real sort of perspective. And then the guys who were on the other side of the table, Dustin Hoffman and the producer and the director, saw her as this weak, fragile, traumatized young actor who was still in the throes of grief from John Cazale's death, and they knew about that she had gone through this. And they felt that, oh, she's perfect for this part because, you know, Joanna is a fragile person. She's, you know, basically having a nervous breakdown. And Meryl can bring that experience to the part. So at first I heard these two different stories of the audition and was so frustrated. I wanted to know, well, which one was it? And then I realized that it's actually much more interesting that there are two different perspectives, because obviously the way she saw herself was hugely different than how Dustin Hoffman and the other guys in the room saw her. You know, in essence, she thought that her strength had gotten her the part, and they thought that her weakness had gotten her the part. And that kind of played out through the course of making the movie.
Hmm. To the point you tell us that Dustin Hoffman would actually, at certain dramatic points in the filming, would whisper John Cazale's name into Meryl Streep's ear as though taunting her. I mean, but taunting her with the purpose of touching on this intense emotional fragility. Although you tell us Meryl Streep ultimately really resented that kind of manipulative treatment because in a sense that wasn't giving her credit for being capable of portraying Joanna on her own, strictly from the reservoir of her own extraordinary talent.
Right. Well, Dustin Hoffman was a hardcore method actor, you know. In method acting, you draw on your own experience, your own life, your own trauma in order to project it onto a character. And not only was he doing that, but he felt like he should do it for his co-stars as well and kind of use what he knew about their lives and their vulnerabilities to get them upset for a scene. So with Meryl, he knew that she had gone through this horrible experience with John Cazale, and at moments in the script, in the story, when she had to break down and cry and, you know, sort of implode, he would bring it up and sort of throw his name, the name John Cazale, at her from the other side of the camera in order to get her upset or riled up. And, you know, at this point, he was a really big, important leading man and had kind of all the power in the room. And she was, at that point, really unknown in movies. She was a 28, 29-year-old actress who really hadn't done that much. But what he didn't know is that, you know, she was Meryl Streep. She could deliver any emotion at any time, anywhere. And the way she works is not method acting. She's really not a method actress. She really doesn't feel like she has to mine her own pain to get it right. She works from empathy and imagination. And at one point, she compared herself to Margaret Mead, the anthropologist who went to Samoa. You know, she can travel through her imagination to other people's lives.
Right. At the time was not a mother, of course, and so it's in no way was she playing herself. But you tell us she sat in a playground at Central Park and watched the Upper East Side mothers with their perambulators trying to outdo one another. She soaked in the atmosphere, thought about these women, and then she read Margaret Mead's memoir, Blackberry Winter, and you write, it occurred to her that people outside an experience often have greater insight than the ones living it. Mead had wed her own instincts with the power of observation and gotten at something very deep. Unlike Joanna Kramer, Meryl wasn't a mother or a wife, and she didn't live on the Upper East Side. But she could travel there in her imagination, just as Mead had traveled to the South Pacific.
Right. So imagine coming at the role from that perspective and then having Dustin Hoffman at the key moment telling you, you know, like trying to taunt you about your dead boyfriend. It was a completely different way of working between the two of them. You know, this clash of acting, not just acting styles, but personalities. And I think that's it. That was, you know, I had always heard that they didn't get along during this movie, during Kramer versus Kramer. But to find out that was really at the heart of it was so interesting, so fascinating.
Absolutely.
That, you know, it was really a clash of philosophies about acting.
Right. And, of course, out of such a clash could have easily emerged a complete mess, and instead emerged an absolute masterpiece and a stunning performance from everyone concerned, including, of course, Meryl Streep, who wins her first Oscar for it. One thing she says about this that I think is so fascinating is, I did Kramer versus Kramer before I had children, but the mother I would be was already inside me. People say when you have children, everything changes, but maybe things are awakened that were already there. I think actors can awaken things that are in all of us, our evil, our cruelty, our grace. Actors can call these things up more easily than can others. And of course, Meryl Streep is perhaps the most brilliant of them all when it comes to this facet of the art. The book again is called Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep, published by HarperCollins and the author Michael Schulman. Michael Schulman, I'm so grateful for you writing this fascinating book that yields such interesting insight into Meryl Streep and how she has become who she is. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll be meeting two string players from the Chicago Symphony who are soloing this weekend with the Lake Geneva Symphony.